This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League last 16 kicks off with wins for Manchester City and Real Madrid. City had a little scare in Copenhagen, but in reality completely dominated almost from start to finish. Kevin De Bruyne scores one, sets up others. Even his tackles put teammates through on goal. Some finish from Bernardo, mind you. In Leipzig, Real ride their luck. The home side will be disappointed not to have got something from it. Brahim Diaz in for Jude Bellingham with a brilliant solo goal. We'll discuss Chelsea's win at Selhurst Park on Monday night as the pressure mounts on Roy. And Big Sir Jim gets the all clear to own a decent chunk of Manchester United. In the EFL, nine goals for Mansfield. More than 80 in Leagues 1 and 2 last night. While Leicester cruise on and there's a big win for Leeds that takes them above Southampton, who lose for the first time in months. All that plus how to differentiate West Ham keepers. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Chortling away at that last bit. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, my love. Mark Langdon from The Racing Post, hello.
Hi, Max.
And hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
Let's start then in Copenhagen. Copenhagen 1, Manchester City 3. When the draw happened, Lars, Man City weren't in the best form. But, you know, that has changed since. And Copenhagen hadn't played for 2 months before this fixture. And it showed, I guess. I mean, perhaps it would have been the same if Copenhagen had played through the winter. But at least they had that moment, right, where the park and just went wild. And you just thought, oh, we've got a game here.
Yeah, incredible finish by Mattsson. Because, you know, the ball came and coming across was actually bouncing a little bit. So getting a clean strike on it wasn't an obvious thing. And it was an incredible hit. But no, you're right. Most of the rest of the game, it did unfortunately look like a team from Scandinavia that hadn't played for 2 months, played proper games for 2 months, coming up against the best team in the world. I mean, which is kind of what it was. I think in the end, and I'm obviously looking at this from a very Nordic perspective, it was a real showcase of what makes Manchester City so good. Because FC Copenhagen does not want the game to look like this. Like, they're not a team who want to sit back and defend in a low block for 90 minutes of the game. It's not what they do. They want to try to play. They want to move the ball around. They just weren't able to because City's press was so efficient, so aggressive. I was watching FC Copenhagen much more closely than I was watching Man City here. And so many times, immediately after they regained possession, they would lose it again within the first pass or the second pass because City were so good at swarming them, never letting them settle. And then you spend so much of the game chasing. When you then get the ball, you don't have the energy, and your shoulders are like, yeah, you're all anxious and tight, and no one's gotten into any kind of rhythm with the ball, and then you make a bad pass, and then City have the ball again for 5 minutes. You know, it became that sort of game, and it's what City can do to you when they're at their best. And FC Copenhagen, sadly, were not able to deal with it, sadly, from my perspective anyway.
Yeah, I suppose that's interesting, isn't it, Mark, in the sense that, like, you look at someone like Burnley, like a team that have the ball the whole time, and they come up to the Premier League and don't have the ball, and you're suddenly like, oh. And then when you get the ball, you want to say, oh, give us a minute, lads. And City is so relentless.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, I think it maybe shows that actually just how good City are. We maybe take it for granted quite often. And their games can feel quite boring in some respects because of the way that they dominate opponents. But, you know, Copenhagen did not play like this against Bayern Munich, for instance, and were able to, and Bayern Munich are one of probably the two teams closest to Manchester City in terms of winning the Champions League. So it was just one of them games for Copenhagen where they're just up against a team that is so much better than them that you can't play your normal style. And then when you're not used to playing in a different way, it's harder. You know, if they played like that every week, maybe it would have been easier for them to kind of accept that they weren't going to have the ball, and they sort of move to a back five in the second half to try to stem the tide. But yeah, it was the sort of difference in class was pretty obvious from a very early stage.
I'm in a worrying position, Barry, of coming to you with a Kevin De Bruyne is good, Phil Foden's good, isn't he? I mean, I thought those De Bruyne's finish was just so wonderful, and Bernardo's as well. I mean, you can pick out whoever you want from that City side, but it seems hard to see, especially that third goal feel like that kills this tie. It's almost hard to see who is going to beat them over two legs.
I think the draw killed this tie. FC Copenhagen earned their place in the last 16, came out with a difficult group with Man U, Bayern Munich, Galatasaray, and then when they get drawn against City, I don't think anyone gives them a hope in hell of laying a glove on them. They scored, but they were comfortably beaten. City had 79% possession, 27 shots to 4. Copenhagen's goalkeeper, Camille Grabera, was their man of the match. He pulled off some excellent saves to keep the score down, and on paper at least give them a fighting chance going to Manchester. But I don't think anyone gives them a hope in hell of turning this tie around, and there's absolutely no disgrace. I mean, even if they had been playing regular football and competitive football, they might have put up a better showing. But as Lars pointed out, or you did, they haven't played for 2 months. You just wonder with this, like in the UK anyway, these Champions League matches confined to TNT Sport, which I think an awful lot of people don't have because they can't afford it or don't want it or for whatever reason. You just wonder, who's watching this game? You know, apart from City fans, who's interested? Because Lars is. Lars has a vested interest, but... sorry, Lars was waving his hand there.
The Scandinavians were hyped.
I'm talking about in the UK, you know. Who's interested in watching this stroll in the park? But that's the way it is now. And an awful lot of these round of 16 games do seem to have an air of predictability. Obviously, you're interested to see how will PSG go out this year. But otherwise, it's kind of hard to drum up much interest for this round of 16, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what you think, Lars. I think there is an interesting point that normally in the last 16, there is sort of one or two real standout ties between two heavyweights, and that just hasn't transpired, which makes you think, well, the quarterfinals, if everything goes to plan, like should be box office, if that's the right word.
Yeah, but this is still the most extreme case of this. I mean, no matter who they were up against, you know, FC Copenhagen would have been the bottom seed of this group of the tournament, and City would be the highest, you know, the bookies' favourite to win the tournament. So when those two are drawn together, yeah, you get a game that can look like this. I'm a little bit, again, with my Danish hat on. It is a bit frustrating that they drew Manchester City, because I think they are a team, as we saw on the group stage, that could do something more. But Man City are an awful team to play against. It's what their coach said after the game, that the first 20 minutes they had a real shock by the tempo of the game. They just couldn't cope with it. And then they kind of grew into it a little bit. But yeah, no, they weren't really able to do anything. And I think there are other ties in this round that will be much more even than this, even though you're right, we haven't had the two heavyweights against each other.
You know, the champions of Spain are playing the champions of Italy. It just turns out that Barcelona and Napoli are not as good as they were last year, and that's not really the Champions League's fault or UEFA's fault. I mean, that would be a mouth-watering last 16 game. But I think it is true that we are missing some of the best teams in Europe. Liverpool, top of the Premier League at the moment, are in the Europa League. Bayer Leverkusen, 5 points clear in the Bundesliga. They're in the Europa League as well. So I mean, there is a slight quirk maybe to the last 16. Even the game that we've got this evening, PSG against Real Sociedad, when the draw was made, looked really exciting. Sociedad's form has tailed off, unfortunately, in the last month or so. So I think it is just one of those things. Just getting back to the City point of view from their midfield, and De Bruyne and Foden and Bernardo and Rodri and all of the quality they've got in there, I do think that midfield is better without Alvarez in it. And, you know, he's been fantastic and carried the goal threat, particularly when Haaland was out. But, this is the balance of the City team that I like best. You can argue maybe about who plays on the left-hand side, but it did feel like you could counter-attack against City slightly easier with Alvarez in there. And when they've got De Bruyne in that position, he gives you the goal threat almost that Alvarez has got. Andy can also do the other things as well. Just a sensational footballer.
Great hair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wonderful hair, of course. We have talked, actually, Mark, about whether Foden and De Bruyne, like, how do you, you know, because Foden was sort of playing where De Bruyne plays, and it feels like Foden's just kind of stayed there, and De Bruyne has come in, and it's fine. Clearly, it's fine because they're both brilliant.
Yeah, good footballers can just play. And I think that Foden is perfectly fine on the wing, and it's nominally on the wing. He's not being asked to do like what Doku does on the other side when he plays. And quite often, him and De Bruyne can change anyway. De Bruyne likes to go wide, plays in that sort of right channel for City quite often anyway. So that just enables City to be fluid, doesn't it? If you've got Foden and De Bruyne, Bernardo can play in a number of positions as well. So that midfield, I think, just works with all of those good players because they're just really talented.
Mm. It's a shame, Barry, for Grealish to get a start and then to have to go off. But it does feel like Doku is a much more sort of incisive player. Like I think the future, when you're looking for interesting storylines to come out of City when they've won another game and all been great, I think that Doku Grealish thing is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Doku is probably the player what Grealish was when he was at Villa before he went to Manchester City and got reprogrammed. There's no indication yet that Pep has same plans for Doku, probably because he doesn't need to, because he has Grealish in reserve, and that seems to be where Grealish is now. And yeah, I'd say he's mega pissed off now. It looks like, I think, a groin strain or something, so I presume he'll be out for 3 weeks or a month with that minimum. And yeah, he had a chance to impress. We know what he can do, but he will be fed up over that.
Lars, you wrote a great piece about Copenhagen for ESPN. Spoke to lots of people there. And one of the interesting things I thought about was they have this amazing academy set up where they basically hoover up everyone in Denmark. And I wonder, you know, are they hated in Denmark by everyone else?
They are a little bit, not necessarily for that reason, but because they're kind of the big showy team from the capital. And also they're quite a young team. They were only founded in the 90s, really. They were an amalgamation of two teams in the capital, and they've had, you know, finances behind them, and the idea is to create the sort of big Danish capital club. And they've always been very ambitious, you know, we're going to be the best team in the country and we're going to be playing in Europe and all this sort of stuff. And that sort of level of sort of naked ambition kind of annoys everyone else a little bit. I think that because of that, there'll be some amongst fans of other clubs in Denmark in particular, there's not a huge amount of affection and respect for FC Copenhagen, I guess. But I think amongst the general population, maybe you can draw certain lines to what it was like in Norway again when we had Rosenborg playing well in Europe. A lot of people in the country thought it was exciting to see a Norwegian team at a great stage. But if you support their rivals, it's not amazing to see that Champions League money ticking into their bank account fairly regularly, because it makes it even harder to compete against them domestically.
And then in this break, I mean, obviously there's nothing they can do about not playing football for 2 months, right? Because it's really not a good place to play football in November and December. And they all sort of go off to Portugal. But like it does seem sort of faintly unfair, I guess.
Yeah, so we have this discussion semi-regularly in the Nordic countries about Denmark, at least they have kind of changed their schedule so that they do follow the normal European league structure a little bit. They do autumn to spring in terms of their championship, but they do have to have this big break in the middle. For Norway and Sweden, I mean, we have summer leagues, and we actually, I would argue, it's a double-edged sword. You have an advantage in the qualifying stages. When you're trying to qualify for the Champions League, your teams are in season, whereas the opponents are not. So at that point, that can be an advantage for you. But there's no getting around the fact that you can't really do. It's like I'm in Stavanger now in Norway, and there's a bunch of snow outside. Like you can't, it doesn't work. Like
get an orange ball. Yeah. What are you complaining about?
It doesn't work. Like you have to have the winter break, and that's always going to be a problem. One of the many problems the Scandinavian teams are always going to have at this stage, which is a sort of funny thing. We talk about FC Copenhagen being underdogs in Europe, because they are. But you got to remember, like, within Denmark and within Scandinavia, they are the behemoth, you know? They can afford to bring players Mo Elyounoussi straight in from the Premier League. They can afford to hand some pretty reasonable contracts to players. And so it's a really sort of, yeah. But they just can't. Even them, they are the one Scandinavian team that has the budget to put together a team that could feasibly do okay in Europe, and they've been able to show some great stuff in the group stage. But you're always going to be at a disadvantage in the knockout stages, and even more so when you have to play Man City after 2 months out. I mean, that is not ideal.
No.
That first half, you could tell they were struggling so much to keep up with the tempo. And the first 20 minutes was pretty brutal.
Well, none of them were sick. So, you know, it wasn't like a preseason game at amateur level. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Real Madrid's win in Leipzig. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So RB Leipzig nil, Real Madrid 1. No Jude Bellingham, Baz, but Brahim Diaz came in and scored a worldie.
Yeah, brilliant goal. Cutting in from the right with a lovely turn. Beat one man, then another. My old pal, Xavi Simons, who's playing for Leipzig, and rifled home and came close to making it a bit more comfortable for Real Madrid towards the end with a counter-attack. He sort of galloped upfield, played the ball wide to Vinny Jr. And he, lovely little side foot with the outside of his right boot trying to place in the corner, but he hit the foot of the post. He didn't look out of place at all, despite the big boots he was asked to fill. But Real Madrid didn't have it all their own way in this game, and I think RB Leipzig would be very disappointed they didn't get at least a draw, if not beat them, because they had, I wouldn't say they had a series of very good chances, but they certainly had, you know, 8 or 9 scorable chances. You would expect them to get a couple. I thought they were unfairly done out of a goal. That Sesko header was ruled out for offside. That would have put them 1-0.
Yeah, I thought it was really harsh.
Yeah.
I thought that was incredibly harsh. I spent all of the first half going, that shouldn't have been, because I was watching the other game and I was like, can someone show me a replay? The guy is miles onside. What's happened?
But no, he was onside, but someone else was offside and deemed to be interfering with the goalkeeper. And I don't think he was. I think it was a very, very harsh decision, which would have made the game far more interesting. But yeah, it was a decent game. And that Sesko guy, Benjamin Sesko, he had 5 or 6 chances. None of them brilliant chances, but you would have expected him to get 1 or 2 at least.
Just on a technical point, Barry, when you said Vinny Jr. side-footed it with the outside of his boot to hit the post, it was a lovely effort. I appreciate that is the side of your foot, but I would never refer to that as a side. Am I the only one? Like, the side foot for me has to be the inside of the foot. The outside of the foot is just the outside of the foot.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I'm still traumatized from getting my West Ham goalkeepers mixed up on Monday.
I'm going to come to your defense on that later on. Yes, Lars?
Well, on that finish as well, I'd be inclined to describe that as a poke, even though it technically wasn't with the toe, because he did the sort of poking motion with the leg. So outside side-footed poke.
Crikey, I'm going to have to be very careful about what I say in future. My every utterance is being forensically picked apart. I'm just going to crumble and become a bag of nerves.
Well, it's a good thing that never happens on this podcast with the very sort of tolerant and forgiving listenership that we over the years. I just thought that this was quite a fun game, I thought, in the second half. First half, not a lot happened, but after Real Madrid got that goal, it kind of opened up a little bit. And Leipzig were going forward. Lunin had to make some really smart saves. And then that opened up for Real Madrid on the counter. So we had a few, you know, quite thrilling Vinicius Junior runs. I was kind of second screening this, and I found my eyes drawn towards the second screen quite a lot. And it really is. Real Madrid, given that they had to play Nacho and Tchouaméni at center half, given that there was no Bellingham, I think they'll be very, very happy to get out of this with the result that they did. But I thought they could have really used Tchouaméni in midfield to stop Leipzig a little bit more, but he did, that's maybe a little bit condescending, but he did quite a good job as a defender, I thought, and bailed him out a few times. And RB Leipzig, a couple of bad decisions in key moments, like Barry said, a couple of chances that were almost big chances, but one bad touch, one bad decision, this sort of thing all the time. So very, very frustrating from their perspective. A decent game all around.
While we're being pedantic, are we second screening now? Is that a verb? I'm not sure I like that.
Oh, I'm turning it into it.
I was thinking I was third screening it, really, because I may have, although please don't tell anyone, been main screening Portsmouth's very lucky defeat of Cambridge United. But, you know, I was fully focused for some parts of this game. It was quite feisty, Mark, wasn't it? Like, Danny Carvajal kicked someone, and then as far as I could see, every time I looked up, someone else was kicking or pushing Danny Carvajal.
Yeah, I mean, I was first screening this game. So I was watching it very closely. And, I mean, even if I wasn't, I would have known that Danny Carvajal would have been involved in anything that was kicking off. And he was determined to get a yellow card, it felt like, and was the main instigator throughout the game, really. I think in terms of the match, I was surprised by how good Leipzig were. You know, 9-3, they won the shot on target count, and Šeško was a big threat, even though he didn't get his goal. And, you know, Dani Olmo and Simons, Appenda, all kind of lived up to their reputation, I suppose, as being players that are going to go on from Leipzig at some stage, just like Nkunku has, Szoboszlai, Garvidal as well. So it is just the way it is for Leipzig. And I've forgotten what your question was, Max. Oh, it was a feisty game. It was. Yeah, it really was.
Doesn't matter, Mark. It's fine.
Was. And Vinicius loves to wind up. The crowd obviously has had some horrendous racial abuse in Spain. This wasn't racial abuse, but he at one stage just refused to move back the 10 yards from to allow Leipzig to take a corner, and that riled the locals, and he seemed to do that for a good 30-40 seconds, I think. So it was a feisty game, and I think Real Madrid were slightly fortunate to get the 1-0 win.
I agree with Barry that Leipzig disallowed goal was really unlucky, but I don't know if Lars or Mark, if you think, well, the guy's sort of pushing very gently, pushing the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper's never going to get it. It's a bit like those line of sight goals where you think, well, if the player is in the line of sight of the keeper, but there's no way the keeper's saving it, that is different, right? There's no way the keeper's going to save this.
So you'll be surprised to know it, I've got the laws of the game open on my web browser here. I mean, I think the relevant bit in the law is that he's interfering with an opponent by making an obvious action which clearly impacts the ability of the opponent to play the ball. I think that's the one he gets done on, because he's kind of stood right next to the goalkeeper and at one point pushes him and is kind of in his space. You can argue the toss of, well, you can't actually argue the toss of whether the goalkeeper would have been able to get to it, because he clearly wouldn't have been. But I think when you're stood right next to him, you give him a little push, all this sort of stuff, you're clearly impacting his ability to do something. I think that's how they
can't argue.
But I've heard someone suggest that the linesman gave it because he probably thought Šeško was offside, and then they checked the VAR and thought, oh, he's not. But then, oh, look, this guy's offside. So it turns out it's okay. Like that's probably, I'd be inclined to believe that that's possibly what happened. But I think the final call is close enough to the scope of the rules of the game for it to not be a massive scandal.
Everyone in Spain will be just nodding their heads because the whole season has been dominated by Real Madrid supposedly getting the rub of the green and every 50-50 call in terms of referees this season. And I think Xavi said even a blind man can see what's going on earlier on in the campaign. So there'll be no shock outside of Madrid in Spain that maybe a 50-50 call went their way.
Who am I to disagree with a man who continually second screening the laws of football?
not outright wrong, but quite jammy, yeah. I think is how I would describe that that call.
Mark, while we're on Real Madrid, like they beat Girona 4-0 at the weekend, now 5 points clear at the top of the league. Is that it for Girona now? Is that dream, multi-club ownership dream, dead in the water?
I think so. You know, 5 points is a lot to make up on a Real Madrid team. It's only lost once, I think, in all competitions this season, growing very much into the campaign, and will soon have Militao back, Courtois, Rudiger was out of the game against Leipzig. Bellingham's got a couple of weeks on the sideline. So that might impact them because he is very important to them, despite the fact that Brahim Diaz got that wonderful goal in Germany. But I would have thought that 5 points is too much for Girona to pull back, and Barcelona not even in the picture, really. So and Atletico Madrid even further behind. So that was a huge win in terms of them claiming the Spanish title, I would have thought. And for Girona, it's more about if they will qualify for the Champions League, and that, despite the multi-club ownership, is still, I think, an absolute remarkable tale, really.
Barry, you've already established how excited you are about the last 16. Are you frothing at the mouth at PSG Sociedad?
I'm looking forward to it, actually, because it's PSG and there's always a chance to mess it up. And I think everyone will be rooting for Real Sociedad. Sadly, Kieran Tierney won't be playing. He's on loan there. There's a brilliant interview with him by Sid in The Guardian on the website. I would recommend seeking it out. He's having the time of his life over there. Absolutely having a ball. Loves it. And it's always quite nice to see when a player goes abroad. You know, he's obviously Scottish, but when a player goes abroad from the Premier League and just has a wonderful, wonderful time. He's played, I think, 16 games for them, but his season's been curtailed by two hamstring injuries, so he won't be playing tonight. But, I will be cautiously optimistic that Real Sociedad can beat PSG, because it is PSG, and on their day, they're capable of losing against anyone. And it's very much, you know, this multi-million-dollar or multi-billion pound or euro state-owned behemoth against, you know, the plucky little homegrown underdogs that's full of academy graduates. I think there's 14 or 15 academy graduates in the Real Sociedad first team squad. So you love to see it.
Do you think when Kieran Tierney eventually goes back to the Premier League, he'll be like, when I got back from my gap year?
I'll tell you, it's what it sounds like, actually. He's on his gap year. He was describing, like, the food he eats there, clams and rice, and how if he, you know, when he tells the lads at home in Glasgow that he's been eating clams and rice, they all just mock him.
There's a very specific reason why I'm looking forward to this game, and why, if you want to make a case for an upset, is that Real Sociedad are like the most aggressive, high-pressing team in La Liga. They're most press-tastic team in the Spanish league. And we know with Luis Enrique's PSG is that they are probably going to play out from the back, and they're not the best team in Europe at it. So I think there's a real sort of possibility. Listen, what could happen is Mbappe could just run away from everyone and score. I mean, that does seem to happen quite often. But I can completely envisage PSG getting caught and ending up on that sort of Twitter account when playing out from the back goes wrong.
Oh, God. Proper football men will love that account, won't they? Lazio Bayern, how do you see this one, Mark?
Still thinking about the clams and rice, actually, Max. We're really making the belly rumble. I think over the two legs, Bayern will win. They should do. They're considerably better than Lazio, not having a great season in Serie A. obviously they need to recover from the shock of just getting a real hiding by Leverkusen on Saturday, because the 3-0 score wasn't one of those games where you know, you can get caught and you know, dominate the game and you just end up losing it 3-0. I think that the team is not functioning properly at the moment. That's on the coach, Thomas Tuchel. He's under pressure, getting a lot of flak. He doesn't believe he's got the right balance to the team and has been moaning about that throughout the season. And they are easy to counter-attack on, but I just don't see sort of Lazio. Last season, when they had Milinkovic-Savic, he was somebody that could make those runs from deep and was a huge player for them. They're just not the same team this year. And maybe one of those reasons why the Champions League isn't as strong as what it sort of traditionally is because, you know, Lazio are not one of the best four teams in Italy this season. So it should be comfortable enough over the two legs for Bayern.
Briefly going back to the clams and rice, is he talking about paella?
You'd normally have more than just clams in sort of a sort of paella. Yeah, calamari,
always a prawn,
sort of squid.
Isn't there in a paella?
A lot of squid,
I think.
Now I'm hungry.
Who was it? Was it somebody famous or just a friend of mine who thought that calamari swam in the sea with like little circles that swam around in the sea? And that's what they were. I don't remember.
I know Kieran Trippier referred to, he didn't realise that, he thought that tapas meant Spanish food rather than little dishes. Oh. and referred to, when he went to Spain, he didn't realise that, you know, you can have little dishes of anything, really, and that's what that means.
According to delicious.com, there is a recipe for Spanish clams and rice, so a separate dish from paella. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, the more prosaic Selhurst Park defeat for Crystal Palace against Chelsea. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Michael says, should Conor Gallagher have apologised for scoring against his old club? I do seem to recall that he scored a last-minute winner for Chelsea at Palace and he didn't celebrate the last time, but maybe he's been away from Palace for long enough or he'd forgotten he spent a while at Palace on loan and he did celebrate. He really celebrated what was basically the winner, the second goal. And boy, Barry, did they need that second half, Chelsea.
Oh, yeah. I was watching this game and I was laughing at how inept Chelsea were in the first half. It was staggering. Just passes under hit,
just
over hit.
Pointing and laughing. Sort of like a Bond baddie laughing.
Just the levels of ineptitude they plumbed after that excellent performance against Villa. And they were playing a Palace team who'd just been humiliated by Brighton. No Michael Olise, no Eberechi Eze, and no Mark Gahey for Palace in this game. So you think they're going to get hammered here, that they've no chance. And, you know, Chelsea did have all the ball in the first half, but just couldn't do anything with it. And then they went behind to this superb goal from Jefferson Lerma. And you're thinking, oh, hold on. But their superiority showed in the end, I suppose. But they left it late.
Petr Cech on Monday Night Football said that Petrovic should have stopped the Jefferson Lerma goal. I mean, I don't. It's sort of just suddenly really thinking. I mean, that just seems very, very harsh, doesn't it? And maybe Petr Cech was just like, I could save everything, you know. But I thought that was quite funny. Pressure. There is pressure on Roy Hodgson, isn't there, Mark? And you know, by all accounts, you know, Ed Aaron's writing in The Guardian that they've been trying to get Kieran McKenna from Ipswich. I mean, that can't help. He obviously has been in the game long enough to know that he is under serious pressure. And it was Stephen Grant, Brighton comedian, was on the radio with me and Charlie saying, you know, that Palace's, you know, their banners, their angry banners are so long. They're like, we're really disappointed with everything that is happening. You know, there's not been enough funding. We haven't really thought this through. Roy Hodgson was, okay, it was a stopgap and now we really should be thinking about this. Like, it's literally just absolutely enormous. But he's under real pressure, Roy, and it's interesting to see what Palace will do.
I mean, I don't think he should have ever been appointed or reappointed when he was. It worked up until a point because he managed to keep them in the Premier League. I don't think they were going to get relegated anyway, but he did make sure of survival. But it was always likely to be a short-term solution. And you mentioned Brighton there. I think the fact that their kind of rivals play such daring football, have got a clear policy on what they want to be, and you know, in terms of transfer market and style of play, that definitely doesn't help when you're sort of looking, I was going to say up the road. It's quite a long way up the road, isn't it, from Palace to Brighton? But you know what I mean from that point of view. And there doesn't appear to be a plan at Crystal Palace for kind of like what kind of coach they want and the type of team they want to be. I think some of their transfers in terms of who they brought in from the EFL have been very good, but it's about having a bigger picture and a bigger plan. And, you know, they were always likely to struggle without the players that you'd already mentioned in that game against Chelsea. But style of play is difficult, really difficult to watch. And I was main screening this game, and then I just got so bored in that first half, as Barry was talking about. I sort of felt like I was nodding off, and the commentator woke me up when he screamed for the Jefferson Lerma goal. But I don't think Palace were going to sort of score in any other way, really. And you know, once Chelsea took the game seriously and started to think about scoring goals rather than just keeping the ball, they were able to win the game.
I mean, in Palace go to Everton on Monday now, which is a real treat for those of us who saw their two games in the third round of the cup and went, yes, more please.
I thought Adam Wharton looked good, though. You never mentioned signing from the EFL. He looks like a tidy player. And if they have all their players fit, you know, next season, presumably in the Premier League, and they have a new manager, it could all change pretty quickly, I guess. The referee's comms went down at half time, caused quite a bit of a delay. I don't think there's a conspiracy theory, but I feel I spend a lot of time watching an official like unstrapping like something on his bicep and restrap. It feels like I spend a lot of time doing that. There's no question or no point to this, but it's just something where you think, oh, could you just get on with it? It's a bit like standing behind someone at a cash point. Not that you do that anymore. That ages me, but you know, going, fuck, this is taking forever. British billionaire Sir Jim Ratcliffe, his deal to buy a quarter of Manchester United has been approved by the Premier League. Well done, Jim. It's worth £1.03 billion. It's still subject to FA approval. The Glazers will retain a majority stake in the club, but Ineos Group, Ratcliffe's Ineos Group, will take control of football operations. We will see what happens with all of that and the gains, however marginal or not that they are. In the EFL, Mansfield beat Harrogate 9-2. And we celebrate that because scoring 9 goals is quite something. I've ranked the goals in order of quality. The 8th, the 3rd, the 2nd, the 6th, the 5th, the 4th, the 7th, the 9th, then the 1st. Because that was a penalty. But I did watch all of them. The absolute highlight of this game was the Harrogate player grabbing the ball out of the net to rush back to the centre circle at 6-2. Yeah, are we still in? They scored two quite quick succession.
It's a dangerous lead, 6-2.
It really is, isn't it? But the Harrogate fans were really going for it yesterday.
Did you see Nigel Clough's comments afterwards where he claimed that Mansfield would have beaten most teams in the world on the night, which given Manchester City were dominating a Champions League game at the same time. He also referenced the celebrating. Do you remember earlier on this season, Nigel Clough was ordering his players not to celebrate too wildly after scoring goals because they would tire themselves out, and he wanted them to save their energy. So he kind of could see this coming, and he just didn't want the players to go too too wild. Otherwise, they might have only won 6 or 5.
Yeah,
was it just Pathé News handshakes all around and jog back to the centre circle?
Yeah. maybe they could have beaten Man City if Man City were also playing Copenhagen at the same time. I mean, that is possible. Yeah, Hiram Boateng got a hat-trick. He's a holding midfielder. I mean, he was great for us when we went up from League Two. In the Championship, Leeds won 4-0 at Swansea. Couple for Willy Nonto. Matt says Leeds, since New Year's Day, have scored 25, conceded 2 maximum points. In any other season, they'd be top by a mile. Danny says, how do you think the Leeds squad will cope in 2 years when we qualify for the Champions League? And they overtake Southampton, whose unbeaten run is over. They hadn't lost since September. They lost 3-1 at Bristol City. Leicester are 12 points clear at the top. Beat Sheffield Wednesday 2-0. Stately home, Kieran Dewsbury Hall with a delightful assist for Jamie Vardy. Who wants to talk about the ridiculous Rabona by, is it, what's his name? Is it Philogene? How do I pronounce this man?
Philogene.
Yeah, so Philogene is dribbling to the byline, cuts back in, is then at a very difficult angle, and rather than do the traditional thing at that point and just cross the ball normally with his left foot, he goes for the Rabona, which floats in over the goalkeeper, at least at first view, and sort of finds the top corner. And you're thinking, we found the Puskas sort of goal of the year winner. Scandalously, though, there is a deflection, and it's been given as an own goal because it maybe wasn't on target. I mean, who are we to know whether there was enough curl on the Rabona for it to have bent in anyway? But, as good an own goal in a different type of way. I mean, we love the Lee Dixon sort of lobbing the goalkeeper from the halfway line sort of style of own goal. But, one of the best own goals in a different kind of way.
Mm, and credit to Charlie Baker for saying fans should sing Philogene is not my lover. It really does scan, doesn't it? Yes, Lars?
I feel like this is where we need an appeals system to the dubious goals panel. There should be the dubious goals panels. When they get involved, it should be possible to appeal on aesthetical grounds, I think, for this sort of thing. There should be a second circuit. Like the dubious goals panels, it has ruled, but you can appeal on grounds of aesthetics, and then there should be a separate panel, which could involve, I guess, some fans and minor celebrities and talking heads from these sort of things who can decide.
Surely scorers of great goals. It should be Lattice and Gianfranco Zola.
I'm just not inclined to give...
And Serge from Kasabian should be
I'm just really worried about what the panel would come up to if you sort of bring Lattice in. I mean, there could be all kinds of weird shit could come out of that panel.
We will do another EFL pod soon. Producer Joel won't sanction it until Charlton win, and they haven't won in 14. So it might be a long time. He's terrified of Charlton in League 2, which... I haven't been in the fourth tier since the 30s, apparently. You can't rattle around in a 30,000 capacity in League 2, but you're never too big or too good to go down. Barry, you wanted to do a little bit about Sunderland Till I Die, Series 3.
Yeah, Series 3, the third and final series of this great documentary, is out. And it's probably the weakest of the three, I'd say. It's only three episodes long. It begins halfway through the season, when they get promoted from League One back to the Championship after 4 years in League One. And I think that kind of takes away from it a bit because, you know, who wants to see success? Abject failure is always more interesting to watch. And I think it also loses out a bit, not really through any fault of the makers. They've still done a fine job. But in previous series, we've had, you know, Stuart Bain, who was the David Brent of chief executives, and then we had Charlie Methven, this public schoolboy idiot in his burgundy trousers, telling everyone that the piss take party stops now, and telling all the staff at the stadium light how incompetent they all are, when it turns out him and Stuart Donald are more incompetent than any of them. But yeah, I enjoyed this. But Kira Louis-Dreyfus is in charge now, the 20-something billionaire, and he's quite dull and far too competent to be the star of this show, you know. So we're relying on the old faces, the fans who've made it so good over the years. Peter Farrar, the cabbie.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Michelle Barraclough and Ian Wake. Yeah, there's no jeopardy in this because, you know, obviously they're going to get promoted. But I did enjoy it. And even though they do get promoted and it's only three episodes long, it still manages to have an ending that will reduce you to tears, an absolute gut punch. So anyone who's seen the first two series, you've got to watch this one. Just see it out.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me nothing is going to continue a piss take party more than someone announcing to you that the party stops here. feels incredibly counterintuitive. I want a man in red trousers spunking millions on Will Grigg, frankly. But you're right, Pete the cabbie.
I feel like I've giving it a bad review. And it's not bad, but it's just not as good as the previous two for the reasons I've kind of outlined. And I think Welcome to Wrexham's really taken over in the football documentary stakes, hasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't got to that yet, I must confess. I really, once I saw the Tottenham team talks, I just thought this can't be all there is. Come on, lads, let's fucking smash them. I mean, I've heard that, I've delivered that. I want more from these guys.
So much footage of men in trainers sort of arriving at the training ground, high fiving people. This is just hours and hours of this. I kind of struggle with these documentaries. I'm sure. I don't know. Maybe it's because so much of my time is spent watching actual football. When I sit down and watch like something like that, I want it to be not football related. But there are just so many of them are just inane and not a lot of fun. I do, from their success, I'm sure the Wrexham one is different. Just based on the sheer number of people watching it, there has to be something good there.
Sorry, but the absolute highlight of the third series of Sunderland Till I Die is when Jack Clark and Patrick Roberts go to visit the East Durham Veterans Association and help out in the kitchen and chat to these guys, you know, many of whom are suffered or have suffered from PTSD. And it's just this group of hairy old men who gather once a week just to chat and exchange old war stories and support each other. And at one point, Jack Clark is standing there having a conversation about kind of mental health with this big beardy middle-aged man who's wearing a Gimp Fist t-shirt. And all you can see is just Gimp Fist. Gimp, what? So I had to Google Gimp Fist. So it turns out they're a punk band from the Northeast.
I see.
Yeah, when you've watched Sunderland Till I Die, be sure to seek out Gimp Fist's back catalogue and give it a listen. Yeah.
If they enjoy the pod, you never know. They might re-record the outro for us. I'd love to be played onto stage for a live show by Gimp Fist. Joe says, regarding the last pod and Barry's comments on West Ham's Fabianski being the only player who came out of the Arsenal game with some credit, was this because he was on the bench for the full 90? Mark, just listen to the pod. Barry was bang on about Fabianski being the only player to come out of the Arsenal mauling with any credit as he didn't play. Same also applies to Julian Dixon, Billy Bonds. Steve, I love it when talking about the positives from West Ham. Barry said Fabianski made some good saves. He didn't play a minute. Gold, he says. I mean, it's on all of us. I mean, I was listening to you and it got past me. It got past producer Joel. I'd like to come to your defence here, Barry.
Oh, thank you.
Even though Lucas Fabianski and Alphonse Areola look nothing alike, there's about a decade between them and they are entirely different people. There is something quite similar about both of them. And it feels like they've both been West Ham's first choice keeper for about 5 years. And I feel that, you know, it's not like, if you think about Vicario and Fraser Forster or Alisson and Kelleher, right? There should be a discernible, like a real noticeable difference. But I think most people, unless they had a close up, I think most people didn't notice. And I think it's very, I think you can't be expected to differentiate between West Ham goalkeepers. I give you full forgiveness.
I would argue, Max, that if you're podding at the highest elite level, you probably should be able to differentiate between West Ham goalkeepers.
Maybe.
Can I say I was slightly offended by the fact I didn't think Areola had played that well either, really. So, I mean, I wasn't sure he deserved... he deserved Fabianski's credit, really. I thought he was as bad as the rest of them.
I mean, the real truth is, now I really will notice who is in goal for West Ham. So, in fact, you've done everybody a favour, because no one will get it wrong for the rest of the season, I'm sure.
Well, it's like that feature we did in our Football Weekly book. Who was it? Vestergaard and
Bednarek.
Yannick Vestergaard and Jan Bednarek. How no one can tell them apart, even though they're completely different people who look nothing alike.
Yeah, but their names are slightly similar, you know, and they're all, you know. I mean, they might be at different clubs now. Who knows? I'm going Leicester and Southampton, but I couldn't tell you who's at which one. let's not go down that path again. Heaven forbid we repeat a joke. Ellis says, which of the panel is best qualified to be super sub for David Squires while he goes through the process of getting over his injury, getting back to match fitness? Guardian Sport cannot play with 10 men. Get well soon. Yeah, our best wishes to David Squires, who tweeted, look, no cartoon this week, I'm afraid. On Sunday morning on an otherwise uneventful dog walk, I became a walking chew toy for a stray Staffy who had taken umbrage to the existence of one of my small dogs. I got in between them and came off worse for wear. If it hadn't been for the help of three blokes who came to my aid, I don't think I'd be typing this. In time, I'll be able to take more enjoyment from the fact that the man who saved me is an Australian called Bluey, which for parents of young children, they will find very amusing. I needed surgery on my upper arm. My drawing hand is fine. Suck it, haters, he says. I need a few days on the sideline. My little dog is fine as well. Look, I chatted to him today. It sounded pretty fucking full on, actually. Excuse my language. Yeah, he's pretty shaken up. But like, if there is anything lucky about being attacked by a violent dog when you're a cartoonist, it's that his writing hand is fine and his drawing hand, rather, is fine. And that is a stroke of luck for all of us, because the guy, I wouldn't say to his face, is an absolute genius. And so thankfully he is okay and he'll be doing cartoons again. Jim says, finally, what did you have in your pancakes? I imagine Mark's resembled an American breakfast stack. Did you pancake, Mark? Did you, you know, what was it?
Oh, pancaking's a verb now too, isn't it? Fuck's sake.
Pancaking, it was a second.
I think it's something from the urban, it's something from the urban dictionary, Barry, I'm almost certain. Anyway, yes, Mark?
I second plated with pancakes after dinner. It was American, yeah, but maple syrup, well, Canadian, North American maple syrup on the pancakes. And I won't be giving up anything for Lent, though, Max, although maybe gimp fist. I might give up gimp fist for Lent.
Fine.
Gimp fisting, that could be a verb too. That would definitely be in the urban dictionary.
I'm sure it is.
Anyway, from Up to Joe, Darren Peacock is the only player whose name contains every letter in the word pancake to have made a Premier League appearance on Shrove Tuesday, doing so in 1995 for Newcastle United. Thank you very much. That is a statistic that I like, and that'll do for today. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Baz.
Ta.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.